So, it is a real pleasure for me to introduce our speaker, Leslie Wickman. If she hadn't been available, you would have been stuck with me talking. That would have been awful. But Leslie is here, and she has an incredible resume. You simply must take a look at it on the website. But I'll just give you a little piece of it. She got her bachelor's in political science in Willamette University.
That's right.
Yeah.
Very good.
And at Stanford, she got a master's in aeronautic engineering. And then also at Stanford, a PhD in human factors and biomechanics. She's had jobs at Lockheed, at RAND, and for the last 17 years at Azusa Pacific. She's done a lot of things. She also plays competitive volleyball. And
what position?
She's retired now, pardon me?
What position?
In volleyball? I play doubles mostly.
Yeah.
Okay.
But
ask me about football. Maybe.
But football, she's retired now, of all things, from women's professional football. She was tight end for the California Quake.
Mm-hmm.
It won the World Bowl, didn't you?
Yeah.
When was that? 2002,
I think.
Yeah, 2002. So if it weren't for some knee surgeries, I think she'd still be playing.
Yeah.
But true. But above all, at Azusa Pacific, she has focused a lot on science and faith issues at the university and dealing with a lot of the students there and the other projects. And we're really delighted to welcome her to our stage.
Thank you.
Leslie.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here with you in cold Massachusetts. My blood has thinned out considerably since I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and so I'm finding it a little chilly, but we're doing okay. We've had some great meals and some great fellowship to warm things up. So this is just an observation before I get started. Some things never change. There are no students sitting in the front row.
I'm still a student.
Okay, all right, good. So the topic of my talk tonight, and let me move out of the way. Can you guys see the screen okay? Should we dim the lights just a touch? Just to see.
See if we can do that.
Improve that a bit. So this is the same topic that I gave a recent TED talk on that's out there on YouTube. Is the conflict between science and faith real? And some people might think it's oxymoronic to even include science and faith in the same sentence, but maybe not. And that's the topic that I hope to unpack tonight. And also be drawing on my recent book, God of the Big Bang, How Modern Science Affirms the Creator, that was published earlier, spring of 2015. I almost said earlier this year, but now we're into 2016, so I can't say that anymore. So for me, this journey to looking at the connections between science and faith started when I was a young child, and my dad had a telescope. So he would take us outside on clear, starry nights, which were somewhat of a rare occurrence in the Pacific Northwest. It rained a lot, so they're especially memorable for me. But we go outside and look at the stars and the moon and the planets, and that really inspired my early interest in science. And I found, even in teaching astronomy more recently, that starry nights tend to inspire the big questions in life. And people start looking at the skies and look at how the vastness of the observable universe and start asking the big questions, such as, where did all this come from? How big is it? How long has it been here? Why are we here? How will it all end? And one of my personal favorites, is there anyone else out there? Okay, so I get asked that question a lot. But in general, starry nights make us think and feel and wonder about life's big questions. And as I mentioned, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, lived in a Christian home, went to church and Sunday school from a very early age. Our family was very involved in the church. And really learned from an early age and believed from an early age that God was the source of all this wonder that we're observing in the heavens. Yet I went to secular schools all the way from grade school through grad school. And in junior high, I encountered my first, what I would call maybe militant atheist science teacher. And he went so far as to say, you might as well just leave your faith at the door, because what you're going to learn here in this science classroom will almost certainly contradict everything you've learned at church. Okay. So he kind of set the stage in a big sort of way for that conflict in my life. And quite honestly, I can look back on that experience so many years ago and be grateful that God put him in my life and allowed me to see that conflict early on and question it. You know, because even back then, I thought, you know, if God is the creator of all this wonder that we observe in nature, then how can his creation possibly contradict the truth about him? It just didn't make sense to me, even at an early age. And, you know, we've heard many times from various sources, all truth is God's truth. If it's true, it's God's truth. Okay. So, again, like I said, from a logical standpoint, how can the truth about creation contradict its creator? So, when I started grad school, I started working at Lockheed Martin in Sunnyvale, California, Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. And I worked on the Hubble Space Telescope program. Anybody heard of the Hubble? and the International Space Station programs. And before too long, I was actually designated as Lockheed's corporate astronaut. And in that role, I went through literally hundreds of hours of astronaut training, flying on the KC-135, there's a picture in the upper left corner there of me on the KC-135, NASA research aircraft, also affectionately and accurately, I might add, known as the Vomit Comet. It's a very good reason why it's called the Vomit Comet. I'm not going to get into that story right now, but
still NASA. Eating.
Yeah, exactly. So, hundreds of hours in the water tanks, simulating weightlessness and operations for servicing the Hubble Space Telescope and assembling the space station. Went through parachute training, got my pilot's license, and on. So, interesting time of my life. And then I've also worked on various NASA projects since then, including the Crew Exploration Vehicle, which is NASA's replacement for the shuttle, as well as the Mars rover programs and some Air Force studies at the RAND Corporation. I'm not going to get into the details of that yet in this conversation either. But more recently, I've been teaching at Azusa Pacific University, as Randy mentioned, for the last 17 years. And while I was there, I was teaching mostly astronomy and other physical science classes. And about almost a year ago now, there was big news in the astronomy community of possible evidence for gravity waves being discovered by the BICEP 2 telescope in Antarctica. And so I was asked by Azusa Pacific's public relations group if I would be willing to talk to a few reporters about the news. And so I talked to a few people over the phone and whatnot, and that ended up leading to an opportunity to write an op-ed article for CNN's website. So they gave me 24 hours to write this piece. So after I got home from class at 8 o'clock one night, I started writing. And anyway, the piece was provocatively titled by the CNN editor. He said, "Does Big Bang Breakthrough Offer Proof of God?" Well, I never would have titled it that myself, but the CNN editor apparently knew what he was doing, and the piece went viral. Okay, so it had over 500,000 views in less than a week. It was in the top 5 worldwide most shared news stories on social media. And of course, you know, in the wake of that, I got all this email, you know, and I would say by the time the dust settled, probably, I don't know, 85 to 90% of it was positive and saying, thanks so much for writing this, it's really helpful. The remainder was what I would call hate mail. So, you know, I mean, people that just had to give me a piece of their mind on the topic. And in fact, one person actually was able to track down my personal cell phone and called to give me a piece of his mind on this topic. So it was really quite interesting. And in the whole experience actually made me kind of realize how polarized people are on topics like this. But I would like to say that I think it's really an illusion of conflict between science and faith. And that illusion of conflict is perpetuated by extreme fundamentalists at opposite positions on the spectrum of this dialogue between science and faith. And furthermore, that I would say that the conflict is not between religion or faith or Christianity and science per se, but rather the conflict is between creationism, okay, as a belief, as a fundamentalist belief, and scientism as a fundamentalist belief. So let's unpack that a little bit. On the creationism side of things, we would have what I would call a 21st century Western biblical literalism. Okay, so people that would look at the Bible, you know, just crack open the Bible, read it in English from a 21st century perspective, and expect to be able to get the true meaning of it. How much sense would it make for us to do that with any other literary work? To crack it open and say, you know what, I'm reading from a 21st century perspective, even though the fact is that this book was written thousands of years ago, and it wasn't written in English, by the way. And try to pretend that we could get the original meaning from it. Okay, and then that's coupled with also a very sudden view of creation. In fact, what could be referred to as almost magical view of creation, in that the idea would be that God snapped his fingers and everything just popped into existence. Okay, so that we have on one side, which I am calling creationism, and on the other side we have scientism, which is a combination of natural science practiced with a purely secular worldview and often associated with godless evolution, okay, writing God out of the picture entirely. So there's where we have this kind of setup for this illusion of conflict. But again, I don't think it's from between science per se or faith and faith per se, but rather creationism and scientism. Okay, I hope that difference is clear. And this idea that science and faith are not in conflict is not just my take on the matter. Okay, a recent study out of, I think it was University of Texas, found that 61% of scientists in the United States identify themselves as Christian. Does that sound like a high number to you or a low number? Is it more or less than what you would expect? How many people think that it's maybe higher than what you would expect? All right, so almost everyone seems that, but it's actually about the same as it is for the American public in general, okay? Self-identifying as Christian, maybe slightly lower. But I would like to present a few pieces of evidence or things for you to think about in this conversation about whether or not that conflict or perceived conflict between science and faith is real. And the first piece that I'd like to present is that modern science actually arose in Christianized Western Europe. Michael Covington, who some of you may have heard of, is a science historian, and he writes on Christianity and science. And he's made the statement that Jews, Christians, and Muslims, all monotheists, believe in a creator who made an orderly, rational, understandable universe and gave us humans permission to investigate and utilize it, thereby legitimizing both science and technology. And on the other hand, we have atheists who can't explain why it's even possible for us to understand the universe. In fact, we refer to Albert Einstein's quote, "The most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. Why can we understand it with our human minds? Why are we able to comprehend the universe and how it works?" This list of scientists are all devout Christians. These people were fundamental in the development of the modern scientific method, and all of them were devout Christians. Okay, the next piece of evidence that I would like to move on to is the Big Bang Theory, not the TV show, but the actual model. And I'd like to point out that the Big Bang Theory is much more God-friendly of an explanation of the universe than the model that came before it, which was the steady state model of the universe. The steady state model held that the universe has always existed. And you may remember the late astronomer Carl Sagan, who would often say, the universe is all that is, all that ever was, and all that ever will be. And that statement actually comports well with this steady state model of the universe, which says, you know, the universe has always existed. It existed. But the Big Bang model, which is primarily based on evidence that our universe is expanding, says that there was a beginning to the universe. And from philosophy, anything that begins to exist must have a cause for its existence. Aristotle would call this the first cause, or God. The cause of the universe. And yet, from the steady state model, if the universe always existed, it could be considered as self-existent and take away the need for an explanation to a beginning. So the Big Bang model of the universe is actually much more God-friendly than the model that came before. Also, the Big Bang Theory stipulates that the beginning of the universe, the Big Bang, was not a chaotic explosion. And Stephen Hawking has written, if the rate of expansion 1 second after the Big Bang had been smaller by even one part in 100,000,000,000,000, the universe would have recollapsed before it ever reached its present state. And these odds are similar to picking the one precise grain of sand out of all the grains of sand on all the beaches around the world. So that's a pretty finely tuned rate of expansion. The next piece of evidence that I'd like to talk about relates to the origin of life. And there are a couple of pieces to this that I want to mention. The first is that just a single living cell contains as much information as 30 volumes of an encyclopedia. And to get a living organism, the odds are even more astronomical. In fact, Walter Bradley, who is another ASA member in our organization, been a longtime member, some of you know him, I'm sure, has written, the mathematical odds of assembling a living organism are so astronomical that nobody still believes that random chance accounts for the origin of life. Even if you optimize the conditions, it wouldn't work. If you took all the carbon in the universe and put it on the face of the Earth, allowed it to chemically react for a billion years, the odds of creating just one functional protein molecule would be one chance in 10 with 60 zeros after it. And trying to put those odds into perspective, that's the odds of taking a randomly shuffled deck of cards and then dealing them out one card at a time in numerical order, suit by suit, until you had all 52 cards dealt out. So you could look at that and go, well, it's probably not going to happen just randomly. So the next thing that I'd like to address is the Goldilocks principle. Okay, this has been referred to as many different things over the years, the fine-tuning principle, some refer to the anthropic principle, but I like the Goldilocks principle. It's easy to remember and very accessible, so it's not too hot, not too cold, it's just right. Not too big, not too small, it's just right. Okay. So if we change anything in this very long list of parameters, life cannot exist. So this is really the observation that there are actually a long and growing list of universal parameters that have to be finely tuned within a very narrow range of values in order to get a universe where life can exist. Okay. And I'd like to go over some of those things, and many of these are things that are finely tuned within our solar system, others are on our planet, and others apply to the universe at large. but let's talk first about Earth's location and size. For example, if the distance between the Earth and Sun were 1 to 2% greater, we would experience a continual ice age. If it were 4 to 7% smaller, closer to the Sun, it would be too hot for oceans to exist. And Earth's size, which gives rise to its gravity and atmosphere and heat, if Earth's size were bigger, it would have greater gravity and hold on to a thicker atmosphere, and it would be hotter on the surface. If it were smaller, it would have less gravity, like Mars, and be colder, drier, and have a thinner atmosphere. Our atmosphere, seen from space, kind of appears to be this thin blue line along the edge of the Earth. And Earth's gravity is just right to keep this thin layer of specific gases just above us. Our atmosphere serves a number of different life-supporting functions. It acts as an insulating blanket from the extreme temperatures of hot and cold in space. If we're in the Earth's shadow and not experiencing direct sunlight, temperatures drop down to roughly minus 250 degrees Fahrenheit. On the other side, where you're in direct sunlight, it can go up to positive 250 degrees Fahrenheit. So imagine those kind of temperature swings on a regular basis without the atmosphere. It also protects us from harmful radiation, especially in the high energy range. For example, ultraviolet radiation blocks some of that. And it's also the perfect composition to support life. If we have time later, I'll get into a few more details along those lines. Our atmosphere, which is 78% nitrogen, 21% oxygen, and 1% trace gases, are the perfect amounts for life. If we have more or less oxygen, we're in trouble. If you have more oxygen, not only do you get more forest fires and burning because of the oxygen for combustion, but also your bodies metabolize things faster, and you age faster, and don't live as long, okay? Too little oxygen, and you suffer from hypoxia, or low oxygen to the brain, and can have brain damage from that. There are some other details, and like I say, if we have time in the Q&A, maybe we can, somebody remind me to talk about the composition of Earth's atmosphere, because it's kind of interesting. Also, our magnetic field that surrounds the Earth protects us from deadly solar winds. So this magnetic field deflects those charged particles in the solar wind and prevents the atmosphere from being stripped away from the planet. It also, interestingly, enables migratory animals to migrate. Okay, so this is kind of a cool little piece of trivia. It's actually not trivia when you think about the implications, but it's kind of a cool fact, fun fact to know and tell. So anyway, migratory animals, in most cases, have a substance called magnetite in their brains. Okay? And this magnetite actually aligns itself within Earth's magnetic field and acts just like a compass. So it enables these migratory animals to know north and south and enables them to migrate. And the reason I say this is not actually trivial is because these migratory animals are a big part of our ecosystem, right? And so they play a very important role in our overall biosphere. Another cool thing about the magnetic field is that there are some kind of gaps in the magnetic field in both the North Pole area and the South Pole area. And this actually allows some of the solar wind particles to creep through and interact with our atmosphere and produce the northern and southern lights. And knowing all this other stuff about how great the magnetic field is and how great our atmosphere is, I look at this as kind of a beautiful reminder of God's creativity in providing this very perfect place for us to live. Another thing about our atmosphere, we've got water vapor within the atmosphere that delivers rain and keeps us warm. It's actually a greenhouse gas, but it's a very friendly greenhouse gas because it enables our water cycle. We need that water cycle. In fact, a lot of times you'll hear people talking about space exploration and saying, you know, we're looking for places where liquid water can exist, right? The thing that kind of goes along with that but isn't expressed very often is not only do you need an environment where liquid water can exist, you actually need temperature ranges and gravity conditions where not only liquid water can exist, but you also have to be able to have liquid in all three phases, okay? In order to get that cleansing water cycle, you have to be able to have water in liquid, gas, and solid phases. So that's often overlooked in this discussion of, you know, is life possible on Mars, for example? Okay, so I just mentioned this, but Earth is the only place in the universe that we have observed so far to have a water cycle which is necessary for life. Also, as you all know, Earth's rotation rate is one time every 24 hours on its axis. If we have a slower daily rotation, temperatures become more extreme. If the rotation is faster, the tropics get warmer and the poles get colder, decreasing the livable space on our planet. And Earth's axial tilt at 23.5 degrees from straight up and down gives rise to our seasons. Without those seasons, we wouldn't have as much farmland available. In fact, with the seasons, it effectively doubles the amount of farmland we have for agriculture. Earth's moon, if Earth's moon were bigger or closer, it would have more gravitational interaction with the Earth, and our tides would be more extreme. In fact, if it was much bigger or much closer, we would have tidal waves submerging our continents on a regular basis. If it were smaller or further away, we wouldn't have as much tide, and the shoreline waters would stagnate. And another really interesting little tidbit as far as the Earth's the relationship between the Earth and the Moon and the distance between the two is that it's the perfect combination for solar eclipses. And you might think that that's kind of trivial too, but the reality is it enables astronomers to study the sun and understand about the composition of the sun and the reactions that produce the heat of the sun and that sort of thing. So it's actually not a trivial point. And someone actually did some calculations to determine, is this a common thing even in our own solar system? And looking at all the dozens of moons around the Jovian planets, the gas giants, they were able to determine there's only one other place in our solar system that you'd have this same relationship, and it's with one of Jupiter's moons. If you were able to somehow get yourself to the surface of Jupiter and survive that, you could actually observe solar eclipses on Jupiter. Another piece of evidence in this whole kind of Goldilocks principle, fine-tuning principle, Earth's crust ranges from 4 miles thick under the ocean basins to 30 miles thick under some mountain peaks. If it were just 10 feet thicker, all of the metallic elements in the Earth's crust with that additional 10-foot thickness increase would have been enough to bond with all the available oxygen in our atmosphere, leaving us no oxygen to breathe. If it were any thicker, or sorry, if it were any thinner than it is, it would increase the amount of tectonic activity, volcanic activity, earthquakes, and volcanic eruptions, which would be quite disruptive. So I hope that from this segment of the talk, you've been able to gather that the Earth that we live in is pretty unique. There have been thousands of extrasolar planets discovered around other stars, and perhaps many of the Sun-like stars out there could support planetary systems. We're discovering more and more planetary systems out there. But all of our space exploration so far has shown that our neighbors in space within our solar system are not remotely capable of sustaining life of any complexity. There have to be a lot of things that go just exactly right in order to do that. And Venus, Earth's so-called sister planet, in fact, I'm kind of on this personal one-person campaign to not call Venus our sister planet? Can we all agree not to do that? Because, it, you know, there aren't very many things that Earth and Venus have in common, okay? So Venus is slightly smaller and a little bit closer to the sun, but that's where their similarities end, okay? The average surface temperature on Venus is about 900 degrees Fahrenheit. The atmospheric pressure of Venus is approximately 90 times that of Earth's, and the space probes that have been sent to Venus and landed on its surface only survive for a few hours before being crushed by that 90 times the atmospheric pressure. And if that weren't enough, its main atmospheric component is carbon dioxide, which is not very friendly to humans for breathing either, right? But even worse, it has clouds laced with sulfuric acid, okay? So it's just not a very friendly place to be, and I don't think it deserves to be called Earth's sister planet. So I think we should all, you know, sign a pact here not to promote that designation to it anymore. On the other hand, we have Mars, which is smaller and a little bit farther away from the sun than the Earth is, and it's very cold. It has an atmosphere that is only 1/100th of Earth's atmospheric pressure. And I don't know, have any of you seen either the original or the remake of the movie Total Recall? Does that sound familiar? Okay. So you remember the part where the guy goes out in the spacesuit without the helmet on? Do you remember what happens?
In the original.
Yeah. And I can't remember if they did that in the remake or not.
I don't think they did.
Okay.
I think Mars is fully terraformed in the new one.
Okay.
Disappointingly enough.
Okay, cool. So right. So anyway, so his eyes are bugging out though. He, you know, and I'm here to tell you that is like the least of his worries. Okay, so what happens when you experience a very low atmospheric pressure is, any scuba divers in here? Okay, so what happens if you go from a high pressure down deep to low pressure up top too fast?
Your blood boils.
Exactly. Thank you very much. That's very helpful. So exact same thing in that scenario where you step from inside the pressurized spacecraft to Mars's very low atmospheric pressure, your blood's going to boil. Okay, so all the dissolved gases in your blood are going to bubble out. And so very quickly, you would become freeze-dried. Okay, so like I said, his eyes bugging out would be the least of his worries. So in any case, neither place is very friendly, and those are really near neighbors. So I like to refer to Jupiter and Saturn as our planetary big brothers. Okay, and it's kind of cool because they are just outside the asteroid belt, which is just outside of Mars's orbit, okay? And they have massive gravity, okay? And they, I kind of also like to refer to them as cosmic vacuum cleaners, okay? They kind of suck up a lot of space junk that would be destined for the inner solar system. And back in 1994, we saw just exactly that happen. Comet Shoemaker-Levy was headed toward the inner solar system, and fortunately, Jupiter intervened with its gravity and sucked it up, and each one of those red marks on the picture of Jupiter there are where comet fragments struck its surface. And each one of those patches is about the size of Earth or bigger. Okay. So that'd pretty much be enough to ruin your day. So, and another way to look at this, we can even take it a little bit farther and draw kind of a spiritual analogy and say that, you know, Jupiter took our hits and was left with our scars. I mean, I'm not trying to be corny here, but, you know, they protect us. It's kind of cool. Our sun is the perfect brightness, size, and age for life. We change anything and we have a much harder time, a much less stable star to support a planet with life on it. And fortunately for us, our sun appears to be a single star with no nearby partner, which is actually quite unusual. Most stars in the galaxy have at least one other partner, with a common center of mass that they orbit around. But fortunately, we don't seem to have one of those, at least not nearby. And somebody put together this little kind of animation. I don't know, can you see the red and the blue circles there? Okay. So this is a kind of a simulation of what would happen if Earth found itself in a binary star system with a second star at 70% of the mass of the sun at 3.3 astronomical units away from the sun, so 3.3 times Earth's distance from the sun. So we're going to run through this real quick. I wonder, maybe we should turn the lights. Can I just do that?
Yeah.
Maybe we turn to
the right lights. Okay, there we go. All right, so far it doesn't look too bad, right? The blue lines kind of overlap each other. Still so far so good. Oh, that was kind of bad. And it's starting to look a little bit like, you guys know what a spirograph is?
Yep. Okay.
And so that's not so good. You know, moving out into Mars's vicinity, kind of. And then that would, again, pretty much ruin your day, right? So it wouldn't be stable for very long. Thanks. And so we find all these different things that are just right for the Earth and its position in the solar system. And you know, if this were just about random chance, you know, you might say, oh, well, we just won the cosmic lottery in doing all these things. And there are people out there that say that, right? But if that were the case, you would expect that one of these parameters that we find, you could tweak a little bit and make it better. But in our case, what we actually observe is that you tweak any of these variables and life can't exist. So it seems like everything's just exactly right for life. And we see this fine-tuning throughout the entire universe, not just within our solar system, not just on our planet. The velocity of light is just right in terms of the amount of radiation we get. The electromagnetic force is just right in terms of the chemical bonding that it allows. The strong nuclear force is just right. In fact, this is one that I know I don't really have time to go into this, but, well, somebody remind me about the strong nuclear force, okay? Because I love to talk about that one. The expansion rate of the universe is just right to allow galaxy and star formation, but not to result in a reversal of that into a crunch. The mass density of the universe is just right to allow for expansion, but not reversing into a crunch. And in fact, the mass density is fine-tuned to the same probability that it would take to pick the exactly right penny out of a stack tall enough to pay off our national debt. That's a lot of pennies. It takes a lot of pennies to pay off the national debt. Okay, so this is pretty much against the odds, right? The probability for just 9 life-supporting design characteristics existing in one of the traditional 9 planets, yes, we're including Pluto here, sorry, is 1 chance in 50 million if we just look at those 9 design characteristics. But if we consider the several hundred finely tuned characteristics of the entire universe, the odds are more like, and this is a kind of a middle-of-the-road estimate here. Some put the odds less, but many put them way higher. But the odds are middle-of-the-road, about 1 chance in 10 to the 280th power for life to exist anywhere in the cosmos. And to put those crazy probabilities into perspective, I've got a couple of different ways I want to kind of illustrate that. The first is, does anybody know what the estimated number of atoms in the entire universe are? Roughly 10 to the 80th, okay? So that's way beyond what these odds are, picking the right atom out of all the atoms in the universe. But let's make that even more extreme. Let's say that there are 10 to the 80th universes out there, and you're trying to pick the one marked atom in all those 10 to the 80th universes. That's still only 1 chance in 10 to the 160th power. So we're not even close to these odds yet. So one of my friends actually did a kind of an analogy for this comparison, that this is like one person buying one ticket for each lottery drawing and winning every time they play twice a week every week for 50 years in a row. Okay? So if I, you know, ask you, you know, if, let's just say that you picked up the newspaper and you read this story about this guy who had done that, right? That he bought one ticket each time he played, and on that one ticket he buys each time, wins twice a week, every week, for 50 years in a row. What would your reaction be?
Cheating.
It's rigged, right? It's set up, okay? So we can say the same thing about the universe. Right? It's rigged for life. It's not just going to happen by random chance. And statisticians will say that any odds beyond the probabilities of 1 chance in 10 to the 50th power go from being statistically improbable to statistically impossible based on the fact that there's just too much that has to line up to be just right to get this situation. So the multiverse hypothesis, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but it currently really is the primary counter-argument to design in conversations about the where did the universe come from and how did we get everything just right. People will say, yeah, okay, I'll admit that this universe seems to have an awful lot of things going for it that are just right for life. But maybe there's an infinite number of universes out there. And maybe that increases the probabilities of getting everything just right. But each one of those universes is speculated to have its own set of physical laws. Well, where do the physical laws come from? And actually, I love this quote from Paul Davies, who's a theoretical physicist. He says, the degree of biofriendliness we observe in the universe seems far in excess of what is needed to give rise to a few observers. If the ingenious biofriendliness of our universe were the result of randomness, we might expect the observed universe to be minimally rather than optimally biophilic or biofriendly. Note, too, that multiverse explanations still need to assume the existence of laws of some sort, so they do not offer a complete explanation of the law-like order of the universe. Finally, invoking an infinity of unseen universes to explain certain features of the universe we do observe seems the antithesis of Occam's razor. It's an infinitely complex explanation, and you probably remember Occam's razor is the idea that the most simple, robust explanations are more likely to be correct. So, for me, science and religion, or science and faith, I believe they go together to enlighten and inform each other as we seek to know the ultimate truth. So, I like this little diagram. I feel like both science and religion, or science and theology, take steps forward toward the truth. And then make corrections, okay? So we see that in the scientific method all the time. I mean, plenty of examples of that, from looking at moving from the geocentric view of the solar system to the heliocentric view, moving from Newtonian physics to Einstein's relativity. We see this all the time in science, where it's iterative. We take steps forward, we take corrective steps backward. And on the theology side or religion side, I would say that Jesus himself represents a paradigm shift to what the Jews were expecting in a Messiah. Right? So he wasn't what they were looking for. He wasn't what they expected. And so I don't think any of us can claim to have either everything about science or either, you know, everything about theology explained. And the things that stand in our way, I think, are articulated by 1 Corinthians 13:12. I know Paul was referring to our knowledge of God, but I think it also applies to our knowledge of God's creation. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, but then shall I know even as also I'm known. And so the things that get in our way of access to that ultimate truth are incomplete knowledge, lack of full understanding, and incomplete or imperfect interpretation. And so I think if we can kind of look at these two fields as moving closer and closer to ultimate truth, we'll see how they go hand in hand even more. And so science is a tool that we can use to explore God's creation if we use it properly. And there are some tips that I'd kind of like to leave you with in terms of getting comfortable with the science and faith dialogue. I'd like to suggest that we approach the dialogue with humility and grace, because we don't have complete information at this stage. We weren't there when God created, so we can't say exactly how he did it. We need to understand the spectrum of positions and arguments on all sides of this dialogue. We need to realize that most people are on a journey. They're still figuring out where they stand. I mean, I know I'm still on the journey, and I've been on it for a very long time, and I still haven't landed at my end point. I think, you know, hopefully when we get to heaven, we'll see more fully. But I think even in heaven, you know, God's going to keep revealing stuff to us. Recognize that these issues are not fundamental to your faith or your salvation, but they are fun to talk about. We should learn to live with the tension and not having it all figured out. We don't have to have all the right answers. And don't let arguments or controversies on this upset you. And finally, in closing, I'd just like to leave with St. Augustine's advice. In essentials, unity. In non-essentials, liberty. And in all things, charity. Thank you.
We've got time for a few questions.
Yeah.
You said that if the Earth's orbit was 1 or 2% farther away, we wouldn't have water. But why does liquid water?
Yeah, I think it was actually, I think it was for the water part, I thought it was the other, so let me get back to that slide. I'm running on empty mentally at this point. It's been a long day, so I'm not remembering exactly.
Needed that slice of pizza.
Yeah, exactly. Oh yeah, here we go. So 4 to 7% closer would be too hot for the ocean. So if we're closer, then we'd have too much evaporation going on.
But Mars has liquid water. So is that because it's a different size?
Okay, that's... We have... Why do you say that Mars has liquid water?
Well, they think there's evidence that Mars had liquid water.
Okay. All right. That's a great observation. And we don't know the full story there. There's been speculation that there may be observations of actually more recent flowing of liquid water there, too. When you look at Mars's gravity, it's 3/8 of what Earth is, okay? And Mars's gravity is not strong enough to hold on to water vapor for very long. And Mars's atmospheric pressure isn't great enough to keep it from evaporating. So there's a lot that we don't really understand about how we have this evidence of water flowing on Mars. You know, is the evidence that we see, could it be explained by flash floods where the water melted and then was released quickly? That it's a great question, but if you look at kind of the planetary physics of it and the amount of gravity that you have to hold on to, it doesn't make sense that Mars could ever have a water cycle. Okay, and this is actually gets back to one of the points that I wanted to talk to about the composition of Earth's atmosphere. So water vapor, who knows what the molecular weight of a water molecule is?
18 grams.
Yeah, exactly, 18 grams per mole, okay. So what about methane and ammonia? Do you happen to know those offhand?
No.
Okay, so methane's 16 grams per mole, and ammonia is 17 grams per mole. Okay. Earth's gravity is finely tuned to distinguish between those. Okay. So we have enough gravity to hold on to huge amounts of water and water vapor, thus sustaining the water cycle. But our gravity is not strong enough to hold on to huge amounts of either methane or ammonia, which is a very good thing because those are deadly gases. And if we had a lot more gravity, like we see in the Jovian planets, our atmospheres would be dominated by methane and ammonia and not be livable. Yeah?
That theory is going along the lines that we were never exposed, if we're going based on the theory that we evolved from cellular life, that's assuming that cellular life was also never exposed to those chemicals, and it's possible that if cellular life had been exposed to those chemicals from the beginning, we might have adopted to use those chemicals. And it might actually be like oxygen to them at some point.
That's an interesting theory. And I hear it all the time. It's like, you know, aren't you referring to life as we know it, right? Carbon-based life that uses water as a solvent and the type of metabolism that we have. But if you look at the laws of physics in our universe, it turns out that carbon-based life is really probably the only kind of life that we can have, given the chemical bonding and the sorts of things that we need for metabolism.
Well, we have found life like at the bottom of the Marianas Trench, mm-hmm. that functioned based on sulfur vents.
Mm-hmm,
and it's
sure.
still carbon-based, but
yes,
it doesn't,
exactly.
doesn't follow the same processes that we would define as regular processes.
But it still uses the same laws of physics and the same types of chemical reactions, right? That's probably a much longer and more in-depth conversation than we have time for or right now. But look into that a little bit more. If you want to, we can email and continue the conversation. But I would argue that given the laws of physics that we have that allow for the kind of chemical bonding that we have, that carbon-based life certainly is the only kind of life that we can get. And it would be tough to argue, I think, that you could get other forms of life using different kinds of metabolism that would develop into complex, intelligent life. But like I said, I'd love to continue the dialogue a little bit more with you if you'd like to, you know, exchange contact information. Is there? Yeah.
You said something about strong nuclear force.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. I love the strong nuclear force. It's kind of cool. And I'm sure that you guys probably have learned about the strong nuclear force in your physics classes. And just the fine-tuning of the strength of the strong nuclear force. You know, it's the strongest force that we know of in the universe. But it's only good for the average diameter of a stable nucleus of an atom. And then it weirdly drops off to zero. Instead of gradually dropping off, it goes from being the strongest force that we know of to zero over a very short distance. And it's very convenient in that, let's just say that we didn't have the strong nuclear force, then the most complex atoms that we could have would be hydrogen, because you need something to overcome the electromagnetic repulsion of the protons in the nucleus of an atom. Okay, so without the strong nuclear force, we wouldn't have anything more complex than hydrogen. Okay, if the strong nuclear force were good for longer distances, then you can imagine what would happen in that case, right? I mean, it would be overcoming the repulsion between all these protons, and you'd have these mega molecules or mega atoms forming. So either way, it'd be tough to get a situation where we have life. So, any other?
One more. Let's take one more.
Okay. Do we know why strong nuclear force is that distance, or do we just observe it and assign constants to it?
We observe it. I mean,
and
like.
And then we do experiments to try to figure it out with the Fermi lab and stuff or something.
Right, but I mean, yeah. Like the fundamental forces and particles in nature, we don't have an explanation for why they exist. You know, I mean, it seems to me, I actually think that one way, it's kind of a thought experiment for you to try on, is to think of God. What if God is like this very masterful computer programmer that sets the initial conditions, he writes the rules. In fact, here's our computer guy right here. And he very masterfully crafts this program for life, you know, and lets it unfold by natural processes, natural laws that are sustained within the universe. And it's mysterious and wonderful and like I said, the analogy of a human programmer is probably pretty weak because nobody's that smart. but I kind of like it. I mean, I think we can look around us and see in the physical world very obviously how God creates through processes. Right? We see star formation, we see galaxy formation. We can look in our own personal lives and see how God uses processes to form us in our spiritual lives. So, you know, why not processes for the whole entire shoot and match?
Okay. Yeah, we'll take one more then.
How would your argument change if we were to find life, intelligent life, somewhere else?
I hope we do. I absolutely hope we do. You know, what I have found in my pursuit of this kind of how do science and faith fit together, every time I turn a corner and learn something new from science, some new discovery, it just makes me stand more and more in awe of the complexity and intricacy, synergies that fit together. I mean, bring on the multiverse, as far as I'm concerned. My God is big enough for the multiverse. And I think it might be kind of arrogant for us as humans to say that we humans are the only created or only intelligent beings that God created in all of eternity and in every universe. I mean, I think it's fantastic that, you know, maybe someday we will have tangible evidence of other universes. And why not? I mean, to me, it only increases my awe of who God is. My God is a really big God who is capable of anything, you know, and I think it would be fantastic if we discovered intelligent life out there someplace else. I think it's, given the conditions that have to exist to get life, from a naturalistic perspective, just by random chance, I think it's improbable. But I believe God created this universe to unfold and produce life. And so he might have done it elsewhere in this universe, but maybe in another universe. And I get excited about that. I think that would be super cool if we could find evidence for other intelligent life. So, you know, search on. Anyway, thanks a lot for your time.
Okay, thank you all for listening.